I had a kind of strange upbringing, I guess. So it was about the age of 7 when the teachers in primary school kind of said, well, yeah, I think they must have said something to my parents, but I don't remember that. But they took me out of class and they would take me upstairs to this, I was in a very kind of small little school. But they took me upstairs, this kind of spiral staircase, and I would sit and I would talk and I would fill in the dyslexia tests. But I didn't know what they were. No one really explained it to me. I think he must have explained that I might have dyslexia, but I was 7. I didn't really understand what it was, didn't understand what was happening. So I filled them in. I would also take some home, because I remember taking some home, but it never really concluded. So I think I moved school, or I left that part of the school, and I never really knew. The only thing I knew was that that I was different, and I kind of guessed that already, being one of very few people who were black in a white school. But I just knew that I was just thought differently, and it wasn't until I actually went to university. So we're talking a good 12 years later, maybe more like 13 years later, that's when I went to university and I was doing my dissertation for a BA, a graduate degree. And they looked at the work and they just said, I think you need to get checked for dyslexia. And then I got checked. I went and got assessed, and they said, yes, you're pretty dyslexic. There's a question like, how did you not know this before? Or didn't they not? So I guess it's just that I don't know how it happened. It just kind of happened. The question of, did I know where I was going to be going? I think because I knew that I was different, it kind of powered me to go and follow my own path and not try and do what everyone else does. I think there was definitely an awakening that I can be, I should not try and follow what everyone else does. I should go my own path, follow my own route. I had an interest in design always, and so I kind of followed that route. That was kind of my degree and my kind of focus all the way through. And then I ended up in research.
I do want to get to this part because I think it's so fascinating, your young adult years. But I also want to get a feeling for the flavor of your childhood. Do you remember what you liked to do when you were little? And were there things outside of school that you found a passion for? Or do you think that those were things that came later in life?
No, I think it's interesting because it was around that time. So I've done this kind of, so I'm doing some reverse mentoring with some of the senior managers in the BBC right now. And we'll be doing this kind of like timeline of your life. And there was a point around the age of about 7, 8, when I kind of became self-aware. I don't think it's quite that, but it became clear that there were things that I was very bad at and things I was very good at. And one of the things I was very good at was drawing. I just remembered this. I used to draw Garfield cartoons. Uh-huh. Yeah. I used to sell them to my friends for probably about 5p, equivalent to, I don't know how much cent that is. It's very small amounts, but for a child, that's probably quite a lot.
It must have been good too, right? It must have been good for them to actually want to pay for it, right?
Oh, yeah. Exactly. I think another thing I really got into, I kind of became very geeky. And I think there's some crossovers with some aspects of dyslexia and kind of like, not necessarily geeky in the sense of someone who is very much into technology, but that kind of drive, that kind of ambition to really understand, that curiousness of things is something that I was really interested in. So about that time, about age of about 9, there was the Coca-Cola yo-yo craze in the UK. And so you used to get these yo-yos and you used to like play with them and you used to learn the tricks. Got really into that, but I got really bored of it. And I was kind of like, this hasn't got enough depth. And so I got into this thing called a wow ball. And a wow ball really is... is a Diablo. So I'm holding up a Diablo. So I've got a lot of Diablos. And that's something that I do all the time. And there's loads of tricks and stuff like that. So I found that I kind of got really into stuff in a deeper level than most people. Most people were more surface, where I would kind of get really into it. I really want to understand it. I really also liked computers. Really got into trying to not just like play games, but also like learn to program them.
Learn to understand. How old was that?
That was probably about the age of about 8, 9.
Wow.
You know.
And well, tell me your parents. Well, is there a background of your parents that they would, you know, they encourage you or,
No, I think my parents were first generation. They moved to the UK from Jamaica. And so they were very much busy working in a Caribbean family. There's a big push to kind of do education. You know, my parents were very much a believer that education is a way of kind of becoming free. So I think that was the big push. But things like computers, I mean, I had to kind of beg my mum and dad to get me a computer. I had the same computer for a long, long time because we didn't have enough money to do that. But it meant that I could, because I had things, I would really understand them and really get into them. I would get the most out of them. I appreciate the fact that I had an old computer, but I really understood how it worked, what it would do, what the possibilities was. And I think that kind of drove that kind of curiousness of like, you know, I need to understand this a bit more. I understand that this thing could have more potential that I haven't explored yet.
So this is interesting to me. So how did you find out more information? Did you actually play around with it, take things apart, put it back together, try to find older mentors, like, you know, just, you know, because you're young, really young. Yeah. So how did you get the information?
Yeah, so I think, there's a couple of things. So I had a few friends that had computers and stuff like that, but not really. They were more playing games. They were not really into programming and stuff like that. I had a godfather or a godson who was very much into games. He was older. I'm still friends with him now. I thought friends. He's my godson. And whenever I used to go around to his house, he had a Spectrum and he would show me stuff. And we would spend all night, you know, my parents would be dragging me away, you know. It was just like, you know, I learned so much through him. I also, one thing that my parents used to do is they used to take me to the library every Saturday, to the public library. And it's a very small library, but I learned a lot by not necessarily, I mean, I didn't really like reading, as you can imagine, but I found ways to skim read. just to kind of like pick up the facts by reading through it very quickly. Not very quickly, but just kind of just reading through it. And I learned a lot through just picking stuff up through that way. Actually, there's a weird thing that happened where about the age of about 8, 9, I read, so there's a children's section, a teenage section, and then there was an adult, the rest of it was adults. And I kind of wandered into the adult section and I picked up a book about drugs, and I just kind of skim read it, and I became very knowledgeable about drugs that actually scared my teachers later in secondary school, because I just understood more about them than they probably, than most people. And I think it's just because of that curiousness. I wasn't curious to try them, especially after reading it. I was like, no chance. But I understood what they did and how they worked and stuff like that. You know, most children at that time were just not interested. So
yeah, interesting. Wow, what a great thing. But that at the end of it, you've got such a huge knowledge database, you know. And sometimes we get into these kind of, you know, these almost wrestling matches with even, you know, some well-intentioned librarians or teachers who feel like they've got to restrict a student to their reading level. And yet there's so much more, you know, and if you really want to encourage them learning, let them dive in, because often it is just really advanced conceptual minds just trying to find out how to bring information in. And the worst thing is to give them a book that necessarily is just completely at their level, because then the ideas can't go running. So that's really cool.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And so, and actually, so maybe that's a good, you know, segue to today. So you are, it's you know, it seems like it would be a dream job, you know, because you're an R&D, you know, where it means like you're an early adopter. Is that right? And you're actually always out there trying to, you know, find out what is going to be valuable. Like it's, it seems like it, if you look at the mind strength, it's like D strength, because you're looking at the chaos, but you're also selecting what really might become something, and that may be nowhere where it needs to be now, but like what's the next big thing, which it seems like a dream job, you know, for a dyslexic adventurer. You know, can you tell me a little bit, like, I'd love to know what the job is now, and then maybe we can back up and see how you, you know, your career path went that way, because it does seem like it's an exciting area, and the, some of the seeds might've been there when you were a little kid.
Yeah, I think there's, okay, so you're probably absolutely right. So I've always prided myself, on being an early adopter, even though I couldn't really afford it, but I would kind of, so for example, I still DJ. Actually, I DJ with a very weird device, which called a, I don't know if people get a bit freaked out when I say it's a pacemaker. So this is this physical device, which is an early adopter device as well. And, you know, I started doing that. So I started getting into circles where, you know, record shops, where there was this whole thing about like getting the first edition of a certain song, looking through bargain bins to try and find that. And I really loved that. So I've got I've still got some vinyl somewhere. And I got some, like, you know, stuff I picked up for 99 pence, which is like classic stuff. So I was really interested in finding the new, trying to find the new. I think the interesting thing for me was I started to, especially when the internet started becoming a thing, and this is before the web became a thing, I started to use bulletin board systems and FTP systems and stuff like that. So what I used to do is I used to, so just as I just finished school, this is before I went to university. There's a stage where I went to college in Bristol, which is where I'm from. And there was a big university which had a 24-hour computer lab. And so what used to happen is I used to go clubbing, enjoy that. And then I'm a night person, so it was like five for me. We would then, some of us would go to the 24-hour computer labs, pretend to be students, and just sit there, you know, on these machines. And you could just, you had the world at your hand. So I picked up lots of stuff. I also got to meet lots of people. People showed me stuff. I think it's just like kind of, I was always curious about how this all worked. So I think through that, I picked up more. But I also pride myself for being the first. I think from that, when I finally went to university in London, money was difficult again. But I always wanted to, I'd spend lots of time investigating, researching, before I make a purchase, you know. So before I buy a laptop, I wouldn't just read what the reviews say or anything like that. I'd be like, right, let me go into detail. What's this review say? What's that review say? How does that work against that? I did all that research. I spent a lot of time researching because I kind of saw it as really important. And so I would kind of wait and then go, right, okay, this is the time to get it. Then I would get it and I would basically hang on to it as long as I possibly could, basically kind of extracting as much value out of it as possible before moving to the next thing. But that also meant that sometimes I did make some mistakes, but sometimes I also made some amazing discoveries. So about the time of when we went from vinyl to CDs to MP3s, I kind of made that jump from vinyl straight to MP3s. And I was telling my friends, you know, this is the future of music. This is back in 1996. Mm. And they were just like, what are you on about? It's all about CDs. I was like, no, this is the future. And I bought this thing and it's in a box somewhere. It's my first MP3 player, which attached to my phone, to an Ericsson phone. You attach it to it and it has little headphones. A little bit of storage. And it was just like, when I had it, I felt so proud and so amazed. Like, oh, yeah, this is it. This is the future in my hands. They didn't believe it. But, you know, now everyone's using these things all the time.
Yeah.
So I think that kind of egged me on. And in the same way, so when everyone was using iPods, I bought this pacemaker. So I was like, it's not good enough just to have music and listen to it. You got to do something with it. There's something important about doing something with it, you know. And so, yeah, I got this pacemaker, which I'm still using today.
I don't even understand. What does the pacemaker do?
Oh, so everything you do with a DJ, so like we got the decks and the mixer and you can mix music back and forth, all of that is now squashed down into that one device. But this device was made in 2007.
Huh.
So this is around the same time as when the iPod was still at the top of its game. The iPhone had just come out. Mm. So people were still just listening to music. They weren't doing anything with it.
Interesting. And so what are the types of things that you actually investigate today, if you can say?
Yeah, I can say. So a lot of the research we do is, because we're a public institution, we try to be as public as possible. It's kind of one of the key reasons why I like working for the BBC. It's all for the public benefit. So I guess the two things that are like hot on my radar right now are, or have been, one is the future of storytelling. The future of storytelling is always been, it's, try not to go and do my presentation now. So ultimately, we kind of went from oral storytelling into publishing. Publishing is amazing. You can distribute to loads of people. But then TV or broadcast just basically made it easier and, you know, we can distribute to even more people. But it's still one way. And the internet has become a way of basically doing broadcast again. And actually, the internet's inherently got the two-way mechanism. So if we look back to oral storytelling, where we used to sit around campfires and tell stories, actually, maybe what we should be doing is looking at that and using that as an example of what we should be doing now. And you're seeing aspects of it, but we're not seeing enough. So that's kind of like a key part of what I do. There's a project I'm working on called Adaptive Podcasts, which allow you to do podcasts. This is what my interest in podcasting, but allow it to adapt and fit your time and stuff like that, rather than just a piece of audio. Mm-hmm. The second one is probably one of the most important ones. And I think it's more important not just for the BBC, but for all public institutions, is I'm investigating and researching what is public service in the age of the internet. Because, you know, it's very clear that, you know, the BBC always gets kind of put up against Netflix. Well, Netflix has got millions and millions of titles, and you've only got this many. It's like, okay, but Netflix are a commercial company who make money from their advertising and from subscriptions. The BBC is none of those, and it's actually it's not just about entertaining you; it's about informing and educating. And those things, those two aspects, are definitely taking a bit of a backseat, in my view. However, there is this other people that have come into this area, the likes of Google, Facebook, even stuff like TikTok and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And they've got a lot of the attention. But what we're trying to do is we're trying to go, okay, there's a space for that, but it's also a space for public... public institutions like the BBC. So if you go back to my library example, you know, yes, you could compare, it'd be easy to compare the library up against Amazon. And if you ignore the payment part, you know, they say, well, Amazon's got millions and millions of books and libraries have got a certain amount of books. Well, actually, one of the things we found is that, one of the things we're researching is that with the libraries are not just about the books. It's about the knowledge. It's about the librarians. It's about the quiet space. It's that space. It's a safe space. So what we found is that a lot of people are using libraries to fill in forms, fill in tax forms. They're filling in visa forms, stuff like that. Because what they can do is it's a quiet space. It's a private-ish space. But if they need help, they can go to someone who probably understands or can direct them in the right place. And so this is the kind of thing that we're trying to explore with the future of public service. Mm-hmm. There's also another key thing. Sorry, another key one is the metric is really broken for public service. If you're comparing Amazon to libraries and you just say, well, libraries not get enough people through the door, Amazon get loads of people through the door or through the virtual door, then we just kill all the libraries. You misunderstand the point of a library. And it's more about we're trying to find a metric which describes the value to people's lives opposed to just their attention, you know, or their footfall, you know, or their eyeballs, in the, you know, stuff like that.
No, that's good. That's great. It's important. I mean, it's like the young you going to the library. I mean, my mom did the same thing. It was a weekly trip to the library, you know, and maybe a basket of books and things like that, you know. But then if you don't have that, if you only really see what you buy, you know, through Amazon, it totally limits that experience. This feeling like you can go there and just pick up anything, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's really important. And you know, and now they have all kinds of things, you know, all their programs and things. Hopefully we'll have them again since they're probably gradually recovering from a lockdown. But yeah. I couldn't agree more. It's very important. So I think, now, too, I mean,
also this is the,
go ahead. No, please.
I was going to say that there's something really important about the institution of a library and like the space, the safe space, the knowledgeable, even if they're not perfectly knowledgeable, they know where to go to find more answers, which is the key thing that I probably discovered when it came to dyslexia, was I didn't need to know the exact answer. I need to know the pointer of where to go to find out. That's right. And I think that probably when I was young, was one of the things that massively changed the way I started to approach school and universities and stuff like that, was I didn't need to know the knowledge. I didn't need to understand. Okay, for a test I did, which is why I probably did very badly in tests, but I just need to know who to go to then get the answer. And that's probably, it's probably one of the things that it's probably one of the things that's really important to me. So I do lots and lots of collaborations, and I'm very good at them because I build this network of people who, not that I rely on, but I just, you know, they trust me, I trust them, we work it out, and it just works really well. And it's really important in the age of, you know, where we are right now.
Great. Now, I apologize for a little bit of this non-linear part. Part of it is just wanting to get in this whole, cover someone's life so quickly. But maybe, because usually, maybe just a little time left, I do want to get to the very end where I ask for your advice for young people. But also, I'd like to connect the dots into how you ended up coming into this particular job. You know, was it a circuitous route, or were there some experiences in your other jobs that made you the perfect candidate for getting here? Because also we have a lot of people who are doing job switches, and also people who are just out trying to get any job but still want to have some dream to aim toward. How did you actually, you know, gain the experiences so that you were the perfect person for the job you're now?
That's a difficult question. So it's weird because, you know, I started off, you know, with a focus on design, and I still have a focus on design. I still think in a design way. I think, you know, I kind of think that's really important. However, one of the things that guided me was my experiences. So, for example, I worked for a startup, a design startup, back in 2000. Just when the dot com was a big thing. And I saw it go from 24 people to 4 people in less than 4 months, as the dot bomb here. I think those experiences, so that experience for me, made me very clear that whatever I do needs to be for the benefit of a bigger aim than just making money. Now, it doesn't work for everyone, but it worked for me. It was an important lesson for me, especially because I normally didn't have lots of money, but it was important that it wasn't about the money. It was deep inside of me that I was either going to work for the government or I was going to work for the BBC. So I started working for my university. Through that and through lots of dinners and chats with different people, I started a couple of social events in London, one called Geek Dinners, which ran for 4 years, 4.5 years. You might have heard of it because there's a Girl Geek Dinners, which is everywhere in the world. And the woman who started that kind of spoke to me and said, "I love what you're doing here, but I wanted to don't want to change the rules slightly." And we talked about it, and it was all her. I'm not going to take anything away from her. But I think those experiences are things that I always saw as learning experiences. And I always kind of like went, okay, I feel like I want to do good in the world. And I want to have a, not an impact on the world. I want to make the world better generally. And so I'm always kind of like, it's like my guiding light, and I'm kind of always heading that way. And so I kind of find opportunities, and then through the opportunities go, right, okay, am I going that way? If I'm not, then I need to go another way. So I'm always kind of like heading in that direction. So practically, I learned from university, from the after university, and from that university, when I went back to university to after the .com, I basically started teaching, which I really loved. I'm still in contact with some of my students. And also I started working for the university doing their intranet and their internet sites. Hmm. And so I learned how to program a little bit. I used to write this language called XSLT, which is an XML language. Once again, because I thought it was the future. I might have been wrong, but I still believe it is. And then from that, I was able to apply for jobs at the BBC. Now, the BBC at the time was very hard to get a job, but I applied for two jobs. I got both of them. The one that I took, I remember very clearly, and this is probably a lesson for anyone, is the job at for XSLT and a thing called Perl language. And I said to them, look, in the interview, I said, I'm an excellent XSLT developer. You know, you will not find a better XSLT developer, and you will not find the XSLT developer and a Perl developer. They do not mix. And they actually, you know, kind of thought about it, and they offered me a job. And then 4 months later, they hired a Perl developer, a guy called Tim, who I'm still friends with. You know, so I think that kind of, to be confident about your own skills and your own, you know, your kind of your thoughts was really, it took me a while, but it was important, because I would hate to have been in a job where I was doing this and that and not really doing that very well. I was kind of very, I thought it was very important that they had, that I say that at that point, and it paid off. After that, so this is why I talked about the geek dinner, sorry. So while I was doing that, I was always, that was more of a kind of like development job. So you're just making sure the website's got this and the other. I implemented, this is going to be funny for you, I implemented RSS feeds into the World Service site. So I have a kind of critical background in RSS. I also was, I didn't write a paper, I kind of, because the World Service has had at the time 43 different languages, I made the RSS that had different languages in it, and kept that. So, you know, it was reversed. So it was right to left. I try to remember what, opposed to left to right. Yeah. Then it had that in there. But I was always pushing forward and trying new things. And I got very bored. And I kept on trying to be part of other things that were becoming quite big. From that, my external life, per se, with Geek Dinners, was getting me some notoriety. And I saw this new thing called Barcamp. And so I guess I combined my external life with my internal life. And it became very clear that there was a new role that was coming about, a thing called BBC Backstage, which was a developer network for the BBC. And so I took that role. partly because of my blog, because of Geek Dinners, and my standing outside the BBC. It was just like, there was no one else who would be a better fit. And then after that all kind of happened, I shut it down, it got absorbed into R&D. And then I shut it down, and I've now become just a senior fire starter in R&D.
That's cool. That's really cool. You know, that reminds me of, there was Erin Egan, she's in Microsoft Business Development, and she said, since she's been in the corporate world, I've never had a job that was actually listed. I actually ended up being, because of that, you're doing all these things anyway. It's part of who you are outside of the job. And then you seem like the only person for the job at the end of it, because, it's this very distinctive role you end up having. So that's really cool.
Yeah. I think there's definitely something about, I kind of created this role that I have, because it didn't really exist. It kind of sits in, so BBC has this kind of weird thing where they use TV like names for people. So I'm officially a producer, but I just started to call myself a fire starter, which seemed more apt. And I know once if I was to leave, that role would disappear, because I carved it out for myself.
Yeah. Okay. And the last little bit that I have here, advice to young people, or actually old people too, just advice that you might have just, with all the experiences that you've had.
Okay. So I actually wrote a blog about this.
So well, I will link to it too.
Okay. So I think here's my tips. So sometimes the things we struggle with can be the most rewarding. That's something that I learned quite a lot over my time. It's like you struggle with it, but you actually learn a lot from it. Never be afraid to think visually. One of my things is that I tried doing notes in the way that people do notes. No, I just started drawing mind maps, and it all just went. So I still do mind maps at work. I try to find better ways to do that, but it's important to do the things that work for you. Try not to get annoyed at anyone who corrects your reading or your writing. They're trying to be helpful. There's this quote from a book that I haven't read, but I heard someone else read. It's about this disability. And it was something like, I got a blank on it now. It's something like, I am a person who is, I'm disabled in the world that you've created. Hmm. So in the world that we currently are, I have learning difficulties, but in the world that I'm creating, I don't. You are actually, it's like you're not in the right world almost. So I think that's something important to think about. It's like don't think about yourself as a disability per se, but think about yourself as, you're just not in this current world. It's not quite right for you, but there are other worlds which are better. Just don't be afraid to surround yourself with what you love. That's really important, I found. If anyone grabs a red pen, grab it off them, snap it in two, throw it out a window. Just, the whole kind of like, when people start getting kind of like nitpicky and they start doing that, just put an end to it. It's really important, because it's really important to be able to be honest and say, look, I am dyslexic, and this is not helping. These red pen corrections are just not helping at all. This basically makes me feel really awful. Don't be afraid or scared of a blank piece of paper. Think about it. It's like all the opportunities. Just start writing down stuff, start drawing stuff, start don't be afraid to, like, you know, rip it into pieces and, like, rearrange it, you know. Really just think about what makes sense for you. Don't feel like you have to write it. Write to left if you have to, you know. Just think about it as an opportunity. I think, also learn about what dyslexia is. And I think this is where your book was so powerful. And I actually got it here, actually. Although I didn't actually, funny enough, I didn't actually read this one. I've got it on the ebook. So that's why I read it. I listened to the audiobook. But it's so important to learn about it and to learn about what your advantages are and what your disadvantages are and to really work to them, you know, rather than kind of like bang your head against the brick wall all the time. I think that's probably the most of it.
Fantastic. Yeah, well, that's beautiful. I love that list of advice. It's really great. Your whole life is inspirational. So, you know, bravo for you.
Thank you.